Hello, welcome to the Derm Health Co podcast. I'm Marnie, your host, and today I'm speaking with Matthew Collett, the CEO of Solar D, which is an activated vitamin D SPF technology company. Quite a mouthful, but we're going to explain it all and more in this episode. Matthew shares how Solar D technology creates sunscreen that doesn't inhibit the production of vitamin D. We also discuss the history of sunscreen, something surprisingly we've never covered on the podcast before. And we also talk about some sunscreen myths and what's on the horizon for sun protection topicals in Australia and around the globe. I started by asking Matthew what he thought was the biggest misconception about vitamin D.
Yeah, it's how long's a piece of string on that one? So vitamin D is actually a misnamed vitamin. It's actually a steroid hormone that our body produces when exposed to UVB light that we get from the sun. So that's probably the biggest misconception. It's once our skin gets exposed to UVB light, our body goes through a very complex process and it pumps out what we call vitamin D. So that's probably one of the biggest misconceptions. Also, there's the old versions of what we needed vitamin D for were very much bone health related. Rickets came from lack of sunlight. So, 100 years ago, it was very much, vitamin D was basically needed for bone health. So that's probably another one. So now vitamin D, like I said, it is a very complex steroid hormone that basically every cell in our body has what's called a vitamin D receptor. So it makes our cells stronger by having more vitamin D, and therefore having stronger cells makes us have a healthier immune system. So vitamin D is basically, I wouldn't call it the wonder vitamin, but it basically improves our health in almost every sense you can think of. So having a better, a healthier and stronger immune system helps us fight diseases and keeps us healthy. So that's probably another one that people aren't as fully aware of. I think COVID really put vitamin D on the map because vitamin D was very central to helping fight COVID. There was thousands of studies done on vitamin D and COVID. So that's brought out awareness. So definitely that impact has increased awareness of the importance and the need for vitamin D. Probably the last one is people have this conception that we can get vitamin D from food and supplements. Although we can, but all the research and all the studies prove that we basically get 95% of the vitamin D we need from sun exposure at UVB light. So we can't just take supplements and eat, eggs, avocados, milk. That does help, but that sort of all round adds up to about 5, maybe 10% of the vitamin D that our body actually needs. So they're probably the biggest misconceptions.
So interesting. And today we're talking about sunscreen. So contrasting, for someone that doesn't know about Solar D, to kind of put vitamin D and sunscreen in the same conversation and discuss the importance of that. But before we get into those nitty gritty details, can you share a little bit more about the history of sunscreen and how it's evolved since its inception? Because when I was doing some research for this, I realized, and this is something that you speak about as well, is that sunscreen hasn't changed all that much since it's come into existence.
That's, and very true. And I guess from a perception, it didn't need to change. So, the original sun protection goes back to the Egyptians. They used things like rice and jasmine and lupine and combined it and used it on their skin. The indigenous people of Australia used mud and leaves. So there's always been a version of sun protection through the ages, but it wasn't really till 1938, the Swiss chemist, a guy by the name of Franz Ritter, invented the idea of creating a sunscreen with chemicals. And he did that because he was going walking in the Swiss Alps and got really badly burnt. Mm. And he went, there's got to be a way to fix this rather than mud and leaves. And then in World War II, so he started that process. I think he put a patent in the concept. In World War II, when the US were fighting in the Pacific, all the sailors and the army cadets and the guys fighting were just all getting burnt. So the US actually created a version of this, and it was a sort of a red petroleum sticky horrible stuff, but it worked. They put that on their skin, and that saved them from getting burnt. And then After the war in 1944, a pharmacist by the name of Benjamin Green, who also served in World War II, decided that, you know, this it obviously wasn't marketable. You couldn't sell this product. It was great for the soldiers because they didn't care what was on them. But he added things like cocoa butter and coconut oil. And actually that became what Coppertone launched as the first ever suntan lotion. So that was the start of it. Franz Greta then sort of commercialized that in 1946. In 1962, he then sort of came up with the concept of the SPF rating, which is sun protection factor, which is the rating of protection. So that started in 62. Around 67, the first water resistant came out in a company called Sundown. And then in the 80s, Australia took on the, and the TGA took on the definition of SPF and broad spectrum. And that became the global standard. So broad spectrum now is globally accepted. So since, you know, through that process, since the first sunscreen was ever invented from a technology side, it just hadn't really changed. It was ingredients that we used to either absorb sunlight, which is, you know, sort of majority of sunscreens, and then we've got zinc and titanium, which reflect sunlight. So those, since those were invented, not much had changed. And that's where we sort of came in. We invented our vitamin D promoting technology in which were around 2016. So that's sort of the background and history of sunscreen.
What a fascinating history as well. And it's just progressively people have wanted sunscreen to be less visible, right? So it's essentially invisible to someone else that can't see that it's on your skin. And that just becomes more so that it has kind of verged on that cosmetic product as well, that we have become more aware of what we look like to those around us. So moving beyond the product and then looking back at vitamin D, can you explain the science behind how sunscreens are typically blocking vitamin D synthesis and then how solar D is addressing this issue?
Yeah. So when we talk about sunscreens, we've got to be very careful. We can't use the term block. Except we're not blocking 100%. So what sunscreens were, again, back from the very, very start, was to screen out as much of the UV light. So UV light comes in two rays, one's UVA and one's UVB. They're very different rays. The UVA ray is extremely strong. It's a longer ray that comes from the sun, so it actually penetrates deeper into our skin. It's probably more considered more carcinogenic, whereas UVB light is a much shorter ray. And the UVB is what our bodies use to make vitamin D. The great issue is UVB light, because it is a shorter ray, only reaches the surface of the earth in the summertime and also between about 10 in the morning and 2 to 3 in the evening. So depending on where you are on the planet. So the rule of thumb is, if your shadow is shorter than you are, you have the ability to produce vitamin D from UVB light. So the great dilemma here is, since the 70s, when the Slip Slop Slap campaign started, which was pretty global, we were educated to stay out of the sun between 10 and 2 because it's the hottest part of the day. Therefore, we're also stopping our ability to produce vitamin D. So what sunscreens were doing were adding to that problem, because we put on a sunscreen. So an SPF 50, for example, blocks or screens out up to around 99% of UV light. That's UVA and UVB. So in that scenario, we're actually stopping our body's ability to produce vitamin D by up to 99%. So that's where sunscreens hadn't changed. Vitamin D awareness is recent. You know, studies on vitamin D have gone back a long way, like I said, because, you know, rickets and bone health. More recently, it's only probably 10 to 15 years where the research has really gone into, like I was talking about before, the strengthening of cells and the immune system and fighting diseases. That's only 10 years old. So there has been a move away, I shouldn't say away, evolving that, we do need sunlight. I think the greatest example I love using is, if you water a plant but you stick it in a cupboard and it doesn't get any sunlight, it dies. So, you know, we are a living being. We do need sunlight. We're both UVA and UVB are important to us. So what we've sort of, yeah, that, and that's where sunscreen has added to that vitamin D deficiency problem.
And I'm sure for the longest time they've been looked at in isolated cases, right? Like increasing vitamin D levels through supplementation or food. And then the other part is sunscreen and skin cancer. So it's exciting to see how they're linked together.
Just to jump in. So, and also, I mean, the also great dilemma of vitamin D production and again, sunscreen. So there's so many factors on the way we produce vitamin D. So the darker your skin, the less vitamin D you produce, for instance. So again, if we go back 1,000 years, the center of the planet was primarily dark people, and the northern ends of the planets, or southern and northern ends, the Caucasian type skin was. So now that we're a global, we have African Americans living in North America, they see very little amount of sunlight, but also they've got very dark skin, so they produce less sunlight. And UVB light doesn't travel through clouds, it doesn't travel through pollution, it doesn't go through glass. So these all add to it, as well as the sunscreen. So it's no wonder the globe, I think they say something like 50% of the planet is vitamin D deficient. So that's partly all that combined.
Yeah, and I'm sure I could ask almost everyone I know, and at some point they've probably been on vitamin D supplementation for that reason. So I'd love to hear an overview of Solar D.
Yep.
What is the key innovation here, and what is it bringing to sunscreen technology?
Yeah, so what we've developed is a patented technology that simply, I mean, as I explain that how we produce vitamin D is UVB exposure. So what we've done is developed formulas and a technology that allows some of that UVB light to come through to the skin so we can naturally produce vitamin D. The important part is obviously too much exposure of that UVB light is not great for us. It damages the skin, it ages it, and you know, can be carcinogenic. So what we're doing is playing with the window of what's allowed to be considered in the broad spectrum or SPF space. So we play with that window. So we're opening it enough to allow UVB light through so we can produce vitamin D without causing any sunburn or aging or DNA damage.
Yeah, of course, because you still want to ensure that you're within that global measurements of broad spectrum. And we'll get into the kind of challenges of that soon. When it comes back to, say, practitioners and providers, a lot of our listeners are skin health professionals, whether they're dermal therapists, skin therapists. So one of the main products that they're sending their clients home with before any other skincare regime is sunscreen. So what are some of these misconceptions for therapists and vitamin D that they should, you know, could be aware of that may not be discussed in their traditional educational learning?
Yeah, definitely, especially the dermatologists. So, you know, they're educated that, always have been educated that sunlight is the enemy. So I think, and again, that education is changing. But, you know, if you talk to a dermatologist, they advise to stay out of the sun, but between 10 and 2. You know, that's their message. So that's sort of, I guess, adding to the problem. Like I said, some of the newer or the modern dermas are changing that view, and the governing bodies around the world are now implementing new advisory conditions on, you know, 10 or 15 minutes of direct sunlight is good for you. So that message is changing. So education around that is paramount. So you know, your listener base who work in that derma space or cosmetic space will understand that, you know, they use this sunscreen because, you know, you want to block as much of that UV light as possible to prevent burning and DNA damage. So that education around, okay, well, there is some benefits for some sunlight. And as I think the TGA have it on their website, I think they call it sensible sun exposure. And again, that varies so much between the color of your skin, your age, your health, your latitude on the planet. You know, there's all sorts. So someone in northern Queensland will have a very different sun exposure and vitamin D production regime than someone living in Melbourne, for instance. So that's all got to be part of the education. The thing about vitamin D production and this part of the curve is it's not one size fits all. It literally goes down to each individual. Like I said, especially if you've got diseases around
vitiligo.
Yeah. And I'm thinking of stomach disease and I've got a mental blank. But so because of the process we go through to autoimmune is the word I was looking. So a lot of autoimmune diseases inhibit vitamin D production. So that's a good example. There's a lot, you know, there's a number of these sorts of diseases where doctors will go and advise you and say, if you're living in Melbourne, they'll go, look, for your health, we advise you go live in Queensland because you need as much sun exposure as you can get. So there's that's part of the education, and I think that is slowly changing. Like I said, it is, and it's coming from government and it's coming from regulatory bodies as well. So that's it's a big moving ship in this space, as you know. It's never a quick turnaround, but it's gradually happening. Which, you know, and we've helped with that a little bit from the sunscreen side of things. I mean, all our research, independent research, we've had peer review papers written on us, and that's done by one of the world's leading expert on vitamin D research out of Boston University, a guy by the name of Dr. Michael Hollick. He's very loud, prominent in that space. He's got so much experience. He's almost 80 now, so he's been doing these studies for 20, 30 years on why we need some sunlight, why it's beneficial for us. So I think that's probably the biggest takeaway that I try and get involved in is around that education. And it's great because now we're seeing media, like I said, media and government supporting it.
While still also supporting being safe in the sun and then preventing skin cancer, because I'm seeing an increase over the last couple of years in huge marketing campaigns on preventing skin cancer. So it's such a fine line. And also when you mentioned about some of the guidelines, it's far easier to just have a blanket guideline, don't go in the sun between this time and this time. But you were talking about how dynamic it is depending on where someone lives. Those goalposts are like moving, whether you're in different cities, what the pollution is like. And things, but just some takeaways that we could share maybe for practitioners and therapists. How would you recommend that they guide their clients on the importance of balancing this sun protection and vitamin D protection? Like, are there maybe two or three things that, or a sentence or something that they could share with their clients to balance this?
Yeah, I think probably the biggest takeaway is, I mean, obviously we're trying to educate that some sun exposure is good. And like I said, because it's not one size fits all. So obviously the really pale light skin types, so that the part of, like I said before, about if your shadow is shorter than you, then, you know, you're getting some UVB light and produce vitamin D. On the other side of that is the theory is, and the research is sort of slowly showing this, that once your skin starts to redden, you're probably produced enough vitamin D. So that's the time to get. So like I said, I might go out in the sun, it might take me half an hour to start reddening, whereas another person might take 5 minutes. So the education and the messaging is, go out and get some sunlight between 10 and 2 in the summer, but be very, very careful on how much sunlight you get. Because that's the flip, and that's the I guess from a practitioner's point of view, it's very hard because you're not going to be going out and holding their hand. So it's more about educating the client to say, go out and get some sunlight, and then put on that on the sunscreen. I mean, obviously, you know, the perfect scenario is we've developed something that solves that problem. So having the practitioner recommend our technology is the best of both worlds, because they're going to get that sun protection, but they're also going to have the ability to produce vitamin D.
And that kind of leads me to that next question. I just want to dial in there a little bit further. You mentioned when skin is reddening. So does that, we don't want people to be getting burned every time they go in the sun. So would you say that is a flushing? Like, what exactly is that reddening?
Yeah, again, it's a tough one because we've all grown up in Australia and we've all spent time in the sun, and you know, none of us really sit there sort of glued to the skin and watching it. So I think it's knowing your body. It's a bit like anything. Knowing your body is so important in all types of health, whether it's physical or mental health, is understanding your body and your mind and your heart, knowing what's right, knowing what's wrong. So it's a real juggling act. I think the best way is if you really want to monitor your vitamin D is get it tested regularly. So basically every time you go to the doctor, we recommend that you get a vitamin D test. And they're, you know, that's part of every, and that's part of every testing. You can ask for that. So when you, that helps you monitor it. So if you're saying, okay, well, I, you know, this week I've been out in the sun, and say, you know, summer holidays like we've all just had, I was out, I was, you know, covering up my skin at the right times, I was exposing it for some. And then you can compare at the beginning of summer compared to the end of summer, and you can do your testing and find out, well, okay, it has worked, or it hasn't worked. So it's a balance. It's a period of time where you get to know your skin. Like I said, we all burn at a different rate. We all color at a different rate. So it's just watching it. And like I said, if you're a very, very pale person, you know, I've got a redhead niece, for example. She can spend literally 5 minutes out in the sun and she's going red. So that's, you know, that's because she knows her body. She knows that. So I think that's the probably takeaway. It's a really hard one, because like I said, you're not sitting in a lab getting sun exposure. You're actually on a beach, or you're outside, or at a barbecue, or, you know, so that's the key.
Yeah, and I think that's great advice, to be tested, because that quantifies it. You're not just sitting out there every time, you know, 5 days a week until you go red. It's like, have some exposure, go get tested, see where your levels are at. And if your levels are great, then it's like, okay, pull back a little bit and make sure that you have less sun exposure. You also kind of mentioned in there, then apply sunscreen, but...
Yes, I've got to be careful with that.
so with the recommendation, obviously none of this is medical advice. We're having an educational conversation here. But with the solar D, that's something that you could be applying while you're trying to increase your vitamin D levels, and you've still got that broad spectrum technology that's protecting your DNA.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so again, the real takeaway is, you know, if we have our technology within every sunscreen in Australia, then it's a very simple message. Apply it before you go out, and you'll get your vitamin D intake. If you're using, you know, other sunscreens, then it's recommended you apply 20 minutes before, and then every 2 hours, unless you go for a swim, and then you apply again. So look, that's the TGA recommendation. It's FDA. It's, again, this is part of the education, and things are slowly changing. My view is it will change to, you know, apply after direct sunlight. So you do expose your skin for some. So that may change in the future. But that's the messaging it is at the moment. So it's hard to get around and say otherwise.
Yeah, fair enough. And so my next question was really talking about some emerging trends and research findings that you find particularly exciting or important. I mean, I think just solar D in itself is exciting and important. So maybe we could talk a little bit more about some things that stand out to you that kind of excite you about solar D, and why this is so important in the context of skin health.
Yeah, so again, you know, back to, you know, we've created this technology, and we do have our own brand. Solar D is a brand, but it's not our, it's something we offer to our clients. So our business model is very B2B. So we offer our technology in private label, and we also license the technology. So our clients, we have clients in Japan, India, China, and Australia, obviously. Our clients vary from pharmaceutical, large pharmaceutical global companies who are using our technology to either add to their sunscreen range or launch a sunscreen range. And also we have clients who are very cosmetic driven. So our technology covers, our patent covers any topical lotion with an SPF. So we create tints, moisturizers, face creams, hand creams, night creams, any topical lotion you can think of, even hair care products we can create as well. So we offer our technology to our clients depending on what they want to do with it. Obviously it's all around SPF. But it can be a sunscreen, it could be a face cream, it could be a cosmetic. So that's what's really exciting for us. When we first came up with the concept, we obviously thought this was a game changer in the sunscreen space, but we quickly realized that this is a game changer in skincare. So we're pretty excited about the technology. We're excited about the future of it, because the demand is increasing rapidly, which is great. You know, we've got 3-4 major opportunities in the US, mainly with cosmetic brands. We've got another 5 or 6 here in Australia, got more in Asia, and then we're sort of just touching Europe at the moment. So we do believe, firmly believe the old FOMO concept, that once something becomes popular, and I think water resistance is a really good idea. The first water resistant, which I mentioned, came out in, I think, 1967. I think it was within 3 years, pretty much every sunscreen on the shelf had to be water resistant or no one would buy it.
Mm.
So look, we do know that that's a theme. So we push that, and we've seen the growth. We've grown, you know, last year we grew 100%, for instance.
Wow.
So we see that continual trend. The names we're dealing with are getting, you know, bigger and bigger. And we do know that eventually, that if groups don't have this, they may see that as that they're missing out. So look, that's exciting for us, and we're planning on a pretty big year in 2024.
Amazing. So you're essentially becoming the trendsetters, which I love.
Yes. Yeah, look, and that's it. You know, my theory in business has always been don't invent the wheel, reinvent it.
Mm. Yeah. And you've certainly done that with Solar D.
Yeah.
So when it comes to like the white labeling, is that what you call it? White label?
Yeah. Well, it depends where you're on the world. So some say private label, some say white label.
Yeah. And so is that really just for big players? Is it something that a smaller business could bring in their own sunscreen? How does that work for actually bringing something like that on? And then where does the TGA and all of those things come into it? Is that something that they have to apply for separately?
Yep. So our client base, like I said, we've got some global farmers that use it, but we also all the way down to, I wouldn't call them startup, but early stage cosmetic companies. We have MOQs standard. So look, our MOQ is about 10,000 units per SKU or per product. So it does rule out a lot of the early stage startup concept companies. We've done it that way because we don't want to be that business. We don't want to be sort of doing, there are companies out there that will do MOQs of say 500 units. It's not really our space. We're not built for that. So we traditionally, you know, we're talking to sort of that early stage, mid stage company who have traction. They have a product. They're in Priceline, or they're in, you know, they've got an online presence. So they're already turning over with something, and they see our technology as an add-on.
Yeah.
So that's where we sit. And like I said, some companies, we're doing just purely sunscreen for them. Others, we're launching a tint or a face cream. All of them see it the same way, that they want to launch with something, but eventually they want to build on their portfolio. So the concept is to have a vitamin D promoting portfolio of products, and that's where majority are. I mean, our older clients have already started that process. Some of the new ones are getting there. And that's where we're going, and that's where the upside is. As far as all the TGA regulations, so we use TGA regulated manufacturers. So all that comes with us. So all our most of our clients aren't, you know, if they're a cosmetic, they haven't dealt with the TGA before, or they're not regulated. So we handle all that for them. You have to have what's called an Austell number. Anything over SBF 15 has to have an Austell number, which is applied through the TGA. So we do that for them as well. That's got to be put on the tubes and the packaging. So we run all that process. We tell them what they can say, what they can't say. We tell them what has to go on the back of the tube for all the recommendations. So we do all that for them. And they basically just provide their design. And then we manufacture that for them. So in the end, what they're getting is a fully ready, prepared product, cased, packaged, delivered to hand over to their distributor or to their online presence or whatever they're running.
Mm, amazing. Great business model.
Yeah.
But businesses that are perhaps the smaller clinics and, you know, they're just seeing people or their clients one-on-one, and if they wanted to get in on this technology, is there opportunities for them to wholesale or look at the brands that perhaps you create the formulations for, that they can wholesale those?
Yeah, definitely. So we can introduce our clients to them. Again, we have a variation of clients. We're launching with a surf brand this year, which is probably not related to it, but we've also got a very high-end cosmetic group that is more relatable. So we're very happy to introduce those clients to your listeners and your clients, because they can buy directly from them and on sell, or they can introduce, you know. So there's many ways of making that introduction, but that's you know, we offer that to our clients.
Yeah, amazing. So let's go into like sunscreens. Let's talk specifically about Solar-D, but the challenges for formulating sunscreens for sensitive skin. There's also these concerns about making sunscreen more cosmetically, you know, feel nice on the skin. Some people prefer physical block it or physical sunscreen ingredients. Others have a preference for chemical. What are the challenges in formulating sunscreens for sensitive skin or different skin types and these different formulations? And is this something that Solar-D also is able to facilitate?
Yeah, it's really interesting. When we started we started this as a very much of a technology play. So we're focused on the technology. My background was finance. I'm actually involved in a couple of startups around data security technology. So it was the same sort of model. We private labeled and licensed that technology to bigger firms. So I was very much technology focused, and this business model I understood. When we came down to making the formulas, I sort of let that aside to some of the other experts in our team. So I guess from my vision, it was, you know, just make a cream and, you know, let's get the technology into it. When we originally, you know, my greatest way to look at an opportunity is to do the old dinner party tests and sit at a dinner party and tell people about the idea and get the feedback. And that's really early stage. And you know, usually you walk away with 50-50, but these sort of conversations early was everyone was mind blown. This is a great idea. But every single female would say the same thing. Oh, what does it feel like? And I'd be like, oh, I don't know yet. So it's sort of that changed my thinking. And so to answer your question, yeah, we've spent a lot of focus on the actual formula, the touch and feel and smell. And all our formulas are slightly different, but they're extremely, I like to call them soft. But they're very light. They don't leave any film. You know, you put it on and within seconds you wouldn't know you've put it on. So that was really important. The other, you know, again, back to the navigating that sensitive skin issue. Again, it is personally, so everyone's skin is different and reacts differently to different things. Majority of skin irritation actually comes from perfumes or the oils in the formula. So all our formulas actually are perfume free. They actually don't have any scent. We obviously can add scent or coconut oil or all those sorts of things based on the customer, but we actually, because of that reason, because it's less skin irritation, we get very, very, I mean, our clients get very, very little complaint on skin irritation for that reason. So it's, you know, that's important to us. But, you know, we also can change formulas to suit the client. So we do that all the time. A client may say, we've got this special fragrance that we use in all our other products. We want it in this one, so we add it in. And that, and then, you know, if there's a skin irritation based on that, then that's not our, you know, we're not saying that's sort of something you deal with at your end and they're already used to it. So it is, it's a bit of a minefield because, like I said, everyone's skin's different and they'll react. Some ingredients people have reaction to, it is rarer that it's an ingredient, but it does happen. There are certain, you know, the other big thing we've got to watch is the global move. So at the moment in Europe, there's an ingredient which is very common in sunscreen, and it's completely left my mind. Anyway, it's an ingredient that's used. It's a very small percentage of an ingredient, but Europe are beginning to phase that ingredient out. So that's probably more so what we keep an eye on is the trend on what regulators around the world are doing. There's also the Reef Safe push that's happened in Hawaii the other day. They passed the first group in the world or first government in the world to pass a Reef Safe bill. at the moment, it just covers two ingredients that we don't use. So we can actually claim that we're compliant with the Hawaiian Reef Bill. There is rumours and ideas that they might add to that, add some more ingredients to that Reef Safe Bill, but that hasn't happened yet. So they're the sorts of things we focus on and watch. You know, things like nanoparticles and PARBA are the obvious ones. They sort of been ruled out some years ago, but that's an idea of more so what we angle on. And obviously, you know, like you mentioned, sensitive skin is something we also go on feedback more than we also work with our manufacturers to that they have an insight of on what works with some types of skins and what doesn't.
Yeah, there's so many moving parts with ingredients, as you mentioned, the nanoparticles, the Reef Safe, lots of considerations. And it would probably be quite challenging as a global company to be navigating what's happening in what region, because there's a lot of ideas and studies out there.
Yeah, and some are false as well. So we do hear stories, or we do hear that, you know, the FDA is looking at banning this, and then you find out that, you know, they've looked at it and they're fine with it. So there's always talks and rumours. There's the fight between whether you use physical or chemical, and, you know, there's arguments that, you know, chemicals are really bad for you, but there's, again, no evidence to put that, you know, there's literally no evidence to support that. That was a scare tactic that was, you know, put mainly out by, you know, companies using physical sunscreens.
And I have seen an increase in popularity of physical sunscreens, because traditionally they've been the big white zinc on the nose and they haven't been very appealing to use, but there has been some changes. I think that some of them are more pleasant to use cosmetically. So with Solar D, are you sitting like, could we put Solar D into a cosmetic or a physical sunscreen, or is it something altogether different, or does it cross over both?
Yeah, so physical, so because of our technology and what how I was explaining how it works, we play with that window to let in some of the sunlight. So our technology can only be used with chemical sunscreens. It allows us to play with that window. If we use physical sunscreens, they completely reflect light, so we can't use them. So we do speak to clients, and, you know, they may come back and say, hey, we're just interested in physical, and that's fine. That's sort of the end of the conversation. What we've looked at, that physical trend, like all trends, has begun to swing back the other way. And that's purely, I mean, look, the concept of physical blockers is great because it completely reflects sunlight. It does a great job. Not great for vitamin D production, but great for sun protection. So that concepts work really well. But as we know, and back to what I was saying about, you know, the dinner party test, is they're just not great on the skin, and they never have been. They always leave a film. It has got better, but it's still leaving a film. So from a cosmetic point of view, it's not, you know, it's not highly regarded. From a sun protection or sunscreen point of view, people are happy to use it because it's not cosmetic. But yeah, in the cosmetic space, it's sort of swinging back to chemicals only because of, you know, people are using cosmetics for visual purposes.
Yeah, that's right. And looking at this broader picture of the role of innovation coming into the future, do you see any big evolutions over the next few years?
Look, it's an interesting question. We've probably got our heads in the sand a little bit because we're so focused on our own technology. We do see some other technology develop, but I don't look at it as technology. You know, an example is, say, retinol, for instance, which has been around for years, but now it's become very popular. Niacinamide's another one. You know, so we are seeing that, but we don't really see that as a technology change. It's more of an ingredient change or a change in a concept. So look, we don't see much technology, but like I said, we're not exactly out there looking for it. We do hear the odd story about a competitor that's in, you know, bought out a sunscreen that has vitamin D in the sunscreen. And the great conundrum about that is, if you put liquid vitamin D on your skin, not only does it hardly ever get absorbed, if you expose it to sunlight, it actually evaporates. So it actually doesn't work. So those companies have, you know, never lasted because they're actually selling
the marketing tactic.
Yeah,
right?
They're selling something that doesn't work. And when it comes to the TGA and the FDA, they pull it off the shelf because it's false marketing.
Yeah, that's right. They wouldn't last very long with all the regulations, but people still try. There's always going to be one, right?
That's right.
Well, as we kind of start to wrap up, I'd just like to ask Matt, for those wanting to learn more about the intersection of sun protection, vitamin D, and a bit more about solar D, where can they find out more information?
Yeah, I mean, obviously our website's a good start. So www.solar-d.com is where you'll learn all about our technology. We've got a few pages on vitamin D and obviously sunlight, how to balance it, the history, which I've sort of covered. So it's, as mentioned, we're a technology, not a brand. So we focus on the technology on the website. So that's a good place to start. And obviously, if anyone wants to reach out, they can reach out through that website. There's email addresses on it. So we're very happy to hear anyone if they want to reach out.
Wonderful. And I'll also add that there are some studies on there as well where people can read a little bit more if they like to have a look at what studies have been performed. Quite interesting.
Yeah. So we've got all our published papers and studies. We've also got I think most people really appreciate our news page on, you know, so we've got a detailed news page on vitamin D. There's a few articles in there about our technology, but there's also a lot of articles in there about vitamin D, especially over COVID. Like I said, that really had a lot of media attention, vitamin D related to lessen COVID cases.
Incredible. Well, what a great resource that people can read out for themselves, share with their own clients. So thank you for that. Well, it's been great to hear about the history of sunscreen, this new technology with solar D and the opportunities that are available now and coming. So thanks heaps for your time, Matt.
No problem, and really appreciate getting me on the show.
Yeah, pleasure. Well, that wraps up another episode. Thank you so much for joining us this week. It was wonderful to have you here again. We will be launching another podcast episode next week, so be sure to tune in. And although it's lovely to listen and learn from podcasts, and I know it's easy just to consume and learn and learn and learn, but at one point, the integration and adding what you have learned into your life is really important too. So if you've got some takeaways from this episode, I would love for you to share them with us and perhaps others on social media, because you never know, it might help their business or their professional and personal development grow as well. So make sure you tag any key takeaways from this episode at dermhealth.co and digitalhealth.co. I'll see you again next week. Bye.